I think just we got recorded.
Can we have a moment of silence?
Yeah.
An hour of no talking. Just
a minute of cicadas.
That would be. This was like an April 1st episode. That would have been a perfect bit.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
It's like waiting for Guffin.
Yeah. Just recording in total silence. Oh, that's a good time. Well, hello everybody and welcome again to the Good Trash Honorcast. We gather around a table. We discuss the films you'll never discuss in a film studies course.
And we're anything but silent.
And we're...
I don't like how excited he is. I don't like it.
Well, he loves it when missionaries are murdered.
I've been
around him enough to know.
I have.
He has like a survivor's chart of like all the missionaries. Now, and just...
I have great missionary stories. And
yeah, me too. I won't share any of them on air because this is a family podcast.
Don't know that it is.
I'm still Dustin.
I'm still Arthur.
I'm still Dalton. And they call it that because missionaries told people how to have sex. That's right. We're going to talk about how missionaries are evil sometimes.
It's called
the Common Sutra. That's really good.
Gosh.
The Common Sutra.
Oh, in case you're tuning into the show for the very first time, this is an analysis show, not a review show, and that does mean there will be spoilers, even though we've already mentioned dead missionaries. So if you've never seen the film Silence, directed by Martin Scorsese...
You can't spoil history.
You can't? Well, you know, I mean, you can, because people don't know it. But
that's fair.
If you haven't seen the movie from 2016, which is relatively recent considering the sort of pool in which we usually dip our toe.
8 years ago.
We are starting to dip into the 2010s a little bit more regularly now that we're getting further into the 2020s, though.
So, yeah, we'll see probably more and more of this. But we tend to go further back.
Well, and we tend not to cover films that are sort of highfalutin like this. We don't cover like an auteur's passion project. So why are we covering this film, Dustin?
Because if you go to patreon.com/GTM, you can find how to be a Patreon sponsor of this show. And at a certain dollar amount, you can pick a movie. At this particular rate, Keithan Smith has chosen this film for us to look at. So thanks, Keithan.
Thank you so much, Keithan. $15 a month, I think, gets you a pick on the show.
Yeah.
Sounds about right.
And a free DVD a quarter.
Yeah, exactly. That comes with, you get a free Blu-ray at that level.
That's true.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we'll send you the HD, don't worry.
I think one arrived at your home last month, didn't it?
It's true.
Two nights in the valley?
That's 2 days, two nights in the valley, yes.
2 days in the valley?
Down 2 days in the valley.
I've never heard of it.
I hadn't either. It looks cool. I'm interested. It's got a cool title. Early Charlize,
I think first Charlize, maybe.
Her very first.
Maybe.
She's definitely in the ingenue role for sure. Since my wife's a patron, we just got one. No 4Ks yet, listeners.
But as I was saying, we are going to spoil this film.
No HD DVDs.
Yeah. UHD.
Yeah, HD DVD. That did not last. That's sort of like the Betamax VCR tape,
sure.
Right? Which is not a VCR tape technically, but you know what I mean. Anyway, we spoil the movies, but we avoid doing that in the first third or so of the show. We do a quick synopsis, and then we do thumbs up, thumbs down reviews, which is going to just tell you whether we like it or not, and things we like about it, but nothing about the plot per se. And then we move on to a little game called Explaining the Syllabus, which might involve thematic spoilers, but usually not plot spoilers, and if they are any plot spoilers, they're generally pretty gentle. Then we play some music to let you know we've gotten down to business, and that's the point at which you know all spoiler bets are off. So there you go. That's your warning. Arthur, do you have a synopsis with which to delight us?
After their mentor goes missing, two missionaries travel to Japan in search for him. But every move they make puts them and their fellow Christians in danger.
Mm. Every move they make.
It's almost as if
Inoue is watching you.
Sticking your nose where it doesn't belong has unintended consequences.
Oh boy. All right, we're gonna have a good time today, I am pretty sure.
Today the role of referee will be played by one
you.
Arthur Gordon.
We'll get into it. We'll figure it out. There's no good guys or no bad guys in this. That's
correct.
What fucking rocks.
Correct.
Okay.
So, yes.
I'm tipping my hand a little bit.
But yes, there will be nuance, and then there will be a criticism of nuance. Later on.
Okay.
We'll have all kinds of fun discussions. But before we do that, we have to decide whether or not we together think the movie succeeds as movie. It is made of movie, but is it a good serving of movie or is it a bad serving of movie? I ask you first, Arthur, do you like Silence? Tell me why or why not.
It was good. it's where I'm at. I think we're actually all probably evenly killed as far as star ratings go.
Do we all go four or five on Letterboxd?
Okay. I think it's very well made. I like Andrew Garfield quite a bit. I like to get to see him kind of leading this
project. We don't deserve him. He's just too good for us. He's so good.
He deserves just to live in red spandex is what he deserves. And so
it's distracting, right?
Yeah, him and Ra's al Ghul and Kylo Ren hanging out together is a wild ride.
And I know, right? It's stupid to think of them that way, but that's what happens.
Yeah, that's where they've,
you package somebody.
I mean, Liam's probably least free of that baggage, but
because of his career, I mean, predating if anything,
Qui-Gon, right? And
yeah,
him and Kylo Ren hanging out in Japan.
That's it's,
but well, with the Ewoks,
it's Aslan.
Yes.
No, that's a deeper cut. Okay, sure. it's that air marshal with the drinking
it's
problem.
It's Rob Roy, baby.
Yeah. Oh, there we go. Yeah. The air marshal. Sorry. Yeah, I could think of his character
Oscar
name.
Oscar Schindler.
Nonstop.
That's Jesus Christ.
Well,
yeah. He played Jesus Christ in like an early...
I forgot about that.
Video. It was like his first acting gig.
I did not see that. I did not know
it
that.
I think it was like an actual like educational... thing that the church had produced.
Oh, that's interesting.
Oh, yeah, like a denomination or a single congregation or something.
Something like that. Yeah, Silence is good. It's I've heard a lot about it from kind of inner circles who, you know, Christian background, who really like it and appreciate it. And so, Keithan told me he wanted to do this, and he liked how it paired with his choice from last year, which was I can never think of
A Hidden Life. Oh,
there it is. I can never think of what it's called. Malick's A Hidden Life, mm-hmm. that you covered last spring whenever we did it. And he liked how they paired together, asking a lot of similar kind of questions and dealing with the similar types of themes. Mm-hmm. And, will you denounce your Christ kind of a thing?
March Madness head to head, Hidden Life versus Silence. Who do you pick?
Honestly,
I go Silence.
I go Hidden Life.
I go A Hidden Life right now. I've got more watches of A Hidden Life, and I've been thinking about it for a year. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it just comes up a lot in my head mm-hmm. in a way that, I mean, Silence could. I mean, mm-hmm. in a year from now, that answer could change. But as of right now, it would be A Hidden Life.
I like A Hidden Life, and I think it maybe is.
When I watch it, I notice its flaws a lot.
Yeah.
More.
I think that's.
But it just sticks with me.
It probably hangs together better as a movie in some ways, but I think it's got a much more narrow morality. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The Nazis are there. So
well, I think it's
by
a
virtue of that.
It's a simpler message.
Exactly.
It's not a narrow morality, I don't think. I think that's that cheapens it a little.
Okay, sure. I don't mean to cheapen it. But I think that's maybe a nicer way to put it, though. Yeah, it is sort of a smaller thing.
Mm-hmm.
Silence, though, works. You know, the question of time and Martin Scorsese's come up quite a bit, runtime, I should say, mm-hmm. With Marty and...
dude does not want you to pee.
Yeah, well, and you know, the thing that kind of came up with Killers of the Flower Moon was the way in which the runtime becomes intentional because it makes us complicit in what's happening. Mm-hmm. And that almost feels like what's happening in Silence. It feels a little long, but also that's kind of thematically part of the journey in a way.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of hard to be like, I would have cut out 30 minutes because that's usually my answer to every movie mm-hmm. I watch is let's just cut out 30 minutes.
Well, and I do feel that way about Hidden Life. I think that kind of suffers from length a little more than Silence
does.
Yeah,
I think we talked about that when we talked about that. But I like these actors. I think it picks up quite a bit of steam once Garfield and Driver kind of go their own ways. Mm-hmm. And it becomes, I think, much more forward momentum as we're trying to figure out what's going to happen. Because mm-hmm. They really are in sort of this holding pattern while they're at that first little village island that they arrive at. But it asks questions that I'm interested in. It deals with themes that I'm interested in. I think it's just a well put together film. There's some, you know, I think it's a movie where you're like, you're not really thinking about how can he put in a stylistic shot here or there or a stylistic edit, but he's able to put those flourishes in, even though it is kind of this more dramatic story than you wouldn't expect maybe in this kind of form for him to do those sorts of things, but he still gets to do some of that. And I think it lays out a story that's pretty powerful by the end and raises some interesting questions and thoughts and themes. And so I think it's solid. I think a rewatch would probably hammer in a stronger feeling on it right now. I thought it was very good.
Okay. Very good. Very good. And you were the Virgin Watcher, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I was too.
Oh,
had,
you were both Virgin.
I had not seen it.
I thought you had. Okay.
No, I'd never gotten to it.
Well, go ahead then, Dalton. Do you like it?
I'm a fan. Yeah, I like this a lot. I had to... I watched this on my computer in a chat with a couple other people, so I didn't feel the runtime as much just because there was, you know, other people to watch it with me. I did watch it with some people who were pretty hostile towards it, which I liked. It kind of made me a more critical viewer, and it did make me think more about... I am at war with myself over how much I like Andrew Garfield's performance and how much I find Adam Driver's accent work distracting.
Really?
Yeah, they're doing. I feel it.
It's because they're doing. They should have just told them both to do whatever they wanted, which is probably what they did. Yeah. And unfortunately, they didn't.
And Driver
went.
They
didn't do the Driver same. Really went Portuguese, and Adam or not Adam. Garfield kind of went sort of a little bit, basically his British accent with just a little bit more, you know, mustard on it.
Yeah.
British with a little Syrian mustard on his Portuguese.
It was great.
Yeah. Syrian doing his normal voice, Liam doing his normal voice. Like, and this is sort of the classic problem you run into when you're making an English language film about non-English speaking characters. So like those sort of verisimilitude things, I think can be really distracting in this, especially because you are so much otherwise transported to another time and place. Mm-hmm. And to see these very, not to, you know, I think the cell phone face criticism is dumb, and we've talked about that a little bit on other shows more often than this one, I'm realizing. You don't know this criticism, Dustin. I've talked about this with Sanford recently. It's just sort of this, people who don't like modern actors, especially younger millennials and Gen Zers, because they just... they look like they know what Twitter is. You know what I mean? They're too... and I think what people are really...
cell phone face.
Yeah, that's what you'll hear it called sometimes. I think what people are really bumping up against is sort of the removal of the mystique from the movie star. Is sort of... you still have it with character actors and indie actors who are living more private lives. But these bigger stars, they're so much a brand. They're so much an institution.
Because they have
themselves.
An instant account. Yeah.
Exactly. So I think that really pulls some people out of it. For me, it is more what Arthur is getting at is sort of like the appearance and IP stuff and sort of the ubiquity of those kinds of movies and how that can kind of cheapen an actor's sauce. I don't
especially
know.
Especially when they're
is
doing
it the idea
piece?
Of the movie star trying to play character?
I think
is
maybe
that what you're getting. I mean, because that is the. I mean, that's the root of.
Yeah.
I mean, we go back 100 years, and movie stars are lining the pages of newspapers and magazines, and like people are following their lives. So that's like a weird.
That's true.
Disconnect, unless you're talking specifically about, I can't buy Spider-Man as.
Which for me is
because
not
he has
Portuguese
a beard
priest. Yeah.
Which it's the Brad Pitt thing, right? Like,
sure.
Brad Pitt has tried to make his latter half of his career a, you know, character actor's Robert Redford run. But he's still Brad Pitt, pretty.
And I understand, like, there are logistical, you know.
I don't know why I'm talking like a politician.
I like what you're doing, though. You're really getting into it.
You're going to build that wall.
Uh-oh. The wall between me and Dustin. The one between me and Dustin's about to get taller. It's definitely somewhere in that neck of the woods, Arthur. Because you have to have these guys to get the movie made. I mean, you can just look at Adam Driver's filmography and it is proof in and of itself that his appearance will get the film made. Ferrari, The Man Who Killed Don Quixote, the list goes on. Like, he has been attached to so many auteur long delayed passion projects and like finally got them into existence. So if you're in a Star Wars, you can get the movie made. That also kind of makes you distracting, which sucks because I think Adam Driver is one of the most interesting actors of like his generational cohort.
Yeah, and there's a weird like audacity that they have now because I think about Carrie Fisher, who sort of like resigned herself. You know, she did a lot of screenwriting,
script doctoring,
and that kind of stuff. She did some small appearances, but because
Mark Hamill goes
to voice acting, and they sort of like acquiesced to the. You'll never see anybody other than Luke Skywalker or Princess Leia if you're ever on screen. And there is a sort of stubborn refusal, I think, on the part of some of these A-lister IP actors.
Especially like Hemsworth tried really hard in like the heyday of Thor to do like real projects.
Yeah, I think that was the thing, right? They came to prominence under the IP, right? Versus having a career, then doing an IP, then coming back.
I think that's a good way to put it.
Toby had already had a decent career at Spider-Man. It was a different time then.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, Hemsworth is Thor. I mean, that's how we're introduced to him as Thor, you know?
I mean,
Evans has a career before Captain America, though.
True. And again, all of this is like going to be your mileage may vary thing. Mm-hmm. Like, if you can get past that, I think you're going to have a fine time. And once I sort of got into, because I like Garfield as a performer, I mean, I love Under the Silver Lake. Mm-hmm. I think he's excellent in that. I think that's like really fits into his persona well. And this was like a different thing for him. And I feel like what ended up working for me really well is Garfield as sort of Nafe as sort of this naive lamb in the woods character mm-hmm. who is being put in a position where people trust him more than they should, where people value his input more than they should. And he seems so adrift with it. He like really plays it well, I think. Like he seems the burden of responsibility that he feels like he wears in his performance very well. I think where the movie is most deft on its light on its feet, deft in its storytelling and thematic resonance is when I would say in the late in the second act to early in the first act, or early in the third act, rather, you just have character after character, including Liam Neeson as Ferreira, just spitting bars at Garfield about how wrong he is and like and how obtuse he's being. And that for me is where the movie shines, is of like the way it wants you to think bigger about spirituality, about how we relate to one another. I don't know. I think Scorsese is really doing some shredding that I think only somebody who grew up in an institution as rooted in tradition as the Catholic Church. Like it's, you know, I grew up religious, but that's a whole different kind of thing. It's just a whole different experience. And I think
he studied for the priesthood.
Yeah. I always forget about that. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. I mean, so he was deep in it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and you know, that makes sense as somebody who's committed to storytelling that he would end up in, you know, one of those two fields. Right. But again, like Garfield as too young for his responsibility, which is I'm sure something we'll talk about today. It's just like when somebody chooses to dedicate themselves to the service of others, like there's going to be a learning period where they are out of their depth. And I think for Garfield, he unfortunately his character maybe bites off more than he could chew in this quest he goes on. And that's for me, that's where the movie really works, is just a tale of like somebody going on what they think is going to be a grand adventure, and they're just mm-hmm. fully at sea. Yeah.
You either die a priest or live long enough to see yourself become a movie director.
Something like that. Is it a little too long? Yeah. And I'm just troubled by like, boy, I'm glad this wasn't a big hit, because I definitely see the wrong kind of person seeing this movie and taking the wrong message from it. A message of, boy, haven't we always had it bad as Christians, and boy, won't they do it to us again if they get the chance. And in America, that's simply not the case.
I knew I had a joke to start this show, and I had forgotten it. Oh, that yeah. just reminded me. I was going to make a joke about how persecuted we are in America.
Persecution.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, well.
Yeah. Hey, a lost opportunity. But I think we can talk about that both comically and not comically when we get into cracking this open for analysis. Dustin, you're also at a 4-star, so I guess we should talk about like what works the most and then what holds it back from being like truly revelatory.
I really do like the performances, and I don't have the cell phone face problem.
Yeah.
And so I see Adam Driver. I know who that actor is. So I mean, there's not like a lack of recognition, but he's not Kylo Ren to me. Sure. He's the mm-hmm. actor Adam Driver mm-hmm. in this particular role. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that's not an issue, but I do understand why that is a problem for some viewers of the film. I think the choice of no score or almost no score is really, really telling and very, very useful, I think, for the movie's themes. And I think Scorsese has just the right amount of restraint with the torture scenes to give us the sense of harrowing without it becoming sort of exploitative.
Mm-hmm. It goes as hard as it needs to.
It's a really kind of a perfect touch there. And I'm a big fan of the book. I teach the book in a course. I don't teach the movie. I haven't ever had the opportunity to, but I teach the book in one of my courses where I teach. And I think it's the right kind of adaptation. It's not slavishly faithful. Mm-hmm. There's a couple bits that are different in a ways, kind of different mm-hmm. from book to movie. And there's
that actor's so good.
Oh man, he is. Yeah,
he's great. Shit.
And I've seen him in some other stuff before. And he's usually kind of a goon.
He's kind of a goon in this.
Yeah, he is. But he's often a comedic character.
Yeah.
And so I like to see him in this sort of weirdly kind of ominous kind of role. There's one added bit of dialogue or difference from the book that I think is really kind of a good choice. I don't think this is a spoiler to say, but the initial, if you have to do the fume or not, and Garfield tells him to trample. Mm-hmm. That's not in the book. It's not until much later they sort of makes that sort of evolution, and so that arc is much longer there. But I like that. I think I like that. I like that change because you sort of immediately see a parallelism, parallel tracks that Adam Driver's character and Andrew Garfield's character are running on, and so I think it's making a lot of the right choices. I think the image of Christ in the water is very, very good and well realized. Also, the insert shots of a couple of icons during a particularly decisive moment later on in the film is really, really good. And so I think everything is it's beautiful and it is very thoughtful, and what it is great. Again, we'll talk about takeaways because I think there's a number of wrongheaded takeaways for this particular film.
Sure.
And sure. And so
it's ambiguous. I mean, that's part of why, right? It doesn't tell you what to think about it. And that's part of it's, you know, it was treasurable about it.
But yes, I think the ambiguities of the life of the character of Father Rodriguez is the point of both the novel and of the movie. And I think it defies bigger messages, and I like that about it. I need to talk about the ways in which it defies bigger messages later when we get down to analysis.
Love it.
Because I think there's a number of mistakes that can be made. I think we'll get there when we get there.
I don't know where else to put this. So let's, you know, as we get ready to transition to our next segment, I just want to talk about this. This was really interesting to watch as I'm watching FX's Shogun.
I thought, I wish I'd watched some of it just to get ready.
Obviously this takes place about 40 years after the events of the Tokugawa Shogunate.
I have read the novel, though.
Of Shogun,
yeah.
Yeah, which is obviously fictionalized quite a bit of what actually happened in the rise of that Shogunate. I mean, they changed a lot of the names, I assume, in the book, too. They're changed for the show.
Oh, are they? Okay.
Yeah, of Torinaga in the show versus Tokugawa in you know, actual history, stuff like
gotcha,
that.
Gotcha.
But yeah, it's been interesting to see just like get two glimpses at the history of the Catholic Church in Japan over the span of about, you know, 30 to 50 years.
And the
years.
Sort of Dutch Protestant influence as well. So
sure,
yeah.
That comes later.
Yeah.
Right. Because obviously the Portuguese get there first. And that's sort of what Shogun is focusing on, is like the first non-Portuguese Europeans to like start making contact. Mm-hmm.
And again, just to be clear, dear listener, we're Bush Mills, not Jameson here around the table. And so
we drink Protestant whiskey as it were.
So
that's very good wire reference. Thank you. Yeah. That's an important distinction for us to have though. Right. Like I'm not here to make anybody feel bad about anything.
Right.
I am going to talk about how the Catholic Church confuses me a little bit.
Yes.
And how it holds me at arm's distance from seeing how I could be in that institution and feel connected from the divine. That doesn't mean I'm saying anybody else
sure
should like feel weird about how they do their thing, man.
And I'm probably the most Catholic Protestant many people have ever met.
Yeah. You like some of the what they're cooking on. And I, you know, I'm interested in it because my dad was raised in it. So I'm like, haven't... An interest in it, and you know his son, his birth son's wife was in it deep, and so like I've grown up around people who are into it, and just have always it's intrigued me, and I find it confounding.
So, trigger warning from this point forward. Disclaimer. We are going to talk about some significant religious issues. You know, later on,
the question of faith, the question of faith, God, yeah,
and various sort of denominational approaches, I guess, are going to come up as well, and that can be difficult because
the theological approaches,
absolutely. Yeah. Just because, you know, I mean, as a Protestant clergyman, I have pastored a number of former Catholics, and I mean, anything that even smells of Catholicism is really, really sort of injurious in some senses, and I think probably for many, many. Perhaps converted from Protestant or just long-term, lifelong Catholics. Anything that sort of sniffs of Protestantism can be also kind of very, very itchy feeling. And then if you're generally irreligious, having rejected some of those things, anything that sort of bespeaks anything positive can also make one's hives break out. And so we're going to be very gentle to everybody as we do this, but we're also not going to pull our punches.
I think that's the strength of the film Silence. I think it does that too. I think there is a space for people who are interested in how we navigate this world psychologically and emotionally, whether they have a relationship with faith or not. I think there is stuff in this movie for everybody is my read.
I think so too, but just disclaimer, you know, we're going to kind of cross all the bridges.
You might
feel
itchy. We're going to try to make you not feel too itchy, though.
But yeah,
that's
for
a good disclaimer. I'll do this. I'll take the burden, Dustin. I won't make you mess with Arthur and I. I know you'd love to play Russian roulette with us.
Oh, okay. You want to go do your syllabus
I'll
first?
I'll explain
what it's about, though.
That's what I was going to do.
Thank you.
This is the part of the show we call Expanding the Syllabus, where we talk about the films you wouldn't discuss in a film studies course, and we try to build a film studies course around those types of films. Normally, we would be talking about something like Josie and the Pussycats, like we did last week.
Mm-hmm.
This week, it's a Patreon pick, so we're talking about the film Silence, which you could and maybe should teach in a film studies course. Nonetheless, our assignment remains the same. We are taking Silence, and we are going to put it into a class and try to use other texts to bring out the themes that interest us. That about cover it, Dustin?
That does cover it. Very good. Do you have a syllabus prepared, my friend?
Yes. So I want to talk about Josh Larson, the co-host of Film Spotting. I want to talk about his book, Movies Are Prayers. And I went through...
I heartily endorse this book.
There's a really good review of it.
Heartily. Okay. Yeah, with lots of heart.
Good to hit that I.
It's two sizes too large now.
Oh, no.
You should see a doctor.
Yeah, we got to get you to a cardiologist.
It was good for the Grinch when it happened.
No. It's bad in real life.
Oh, okay.
I got to show you a movie called The Last Action Hero about the difference between movies and real life. I can't believe I didn't get to be on that episode.
I'm sorry.
Anyway, neither here nor there. The book Movies Are Prayers is sort of similarly trying to engage with faith and sort of our relationship to reality and how that relationship is really interestingly expressed in the medium of motion pictures. Right. And I know I'm being like a religious in how I try to talk about this, because I think I haven't read the book, but as I understand, the book does a pretty good job of doing that
mm-hmm,
too.
Mm-hmm.
It is Larson is a Christian, but he's trying to write from the perspective of like movies are our cries to the universe to be heard. Sometimes it's a cry of praise, and, you know, exalting the beauty of the universe. Sometimes that can be a cry of anger. And there's all kinds of things in between, right? So some of the films that I know he cites in his book are Do the Right Thing and Malcolm X. I paired Malcolm X. I don't know if he actually brings it up, but he brings up Ridley Scott's Alien prequels, which I think is really interesting mm-hmm. as far as films about finding a creator and looking for creators. 2001 A Space Odyssey, of course. Those are some of the books that he cites. I'm aware of him referencing in the book, but films that I think would fit interestingly into a class that uses that book and uses this idea. I think we should definitely use Paul Schrader's First Reformed. I think maybe kind of an essential 21st century film as liturgy, film as theological text. Mm-hmm. I also think recently, not new to anime fans the world over, but new to me, I forget his first name, Ono's The End of Evangelion. Especially if you're like really interested in this sort of like headspace of Western theology meets Eastern, I don't even want to say theology because that feels like too small of a word, but like, because Eastern religious thought is very broad. Mm-hmm. I don't want to like try to cram it into one umbrella.
There may not be a deity at the heart.
Exactly.
Right? So, but it's sort of a metaphysical philosophy.
Yeah. I have to say theology isn't even the right word.
But metaphysics
ways.
Maybe. Yeah.
So this mix of East and West and just sort of religion and metaphysics and how this all relates to the human condition, more importantly. End of Evangelion have some good stuff for you. I have a friend who I went with who'd only seen the first few episodes of the anime, and the movie still worked for them. So you can watch the movie having not finished the show. I don't really recommend that, is what I would say. I watched the first 24 episodes of the series and held off on the last two because, as I understand, the movie is kind of a remake of those two episodes.
Mm.
So, but yeah, very much a mixing of all kinds of iconographies and ideas and just throwing it all in a blender and trying to make a kind of internal logic that appeals to all, like, touches on enough different things that it's going to interest a lot of different people and gets kind of esoteric and out there with its reads on human connection in a way that it's really interesting and I think useful for this class. I'm spending the most lip time on this just because I know you and Dustin and Arthur are probably the least familiar with this work.
Correct.
Alhazar Balthazar would be the last one I wanted to mention.
Yes.
A film that I know you love dearly and I think is great for this class. So again, that's how we would use silence and Josh Larson's book, Movies or Prayers, and sort of think about how you can use film either as storytellers and filmmakers or as, you know, film culture consumers, whatever side of film you find yourself on. I think we can kind of use this idea to think more deeply about what films mean to us, regardless of whether or not we are religious or irreligious or whatever in between there may be there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great, great syllabus. Thank you very much for that, Mr. Dalton Stewart. Mr. Arthur Gordon, what syllabus have you got prepared, my friend?
Not so much a syllabus, maybe just a pairing, I think. I think for silence, I'd look at this, maybe the book as well, but then I think I'd put it into conversation as I think about this. I think about that theme of God's silence, and I think I'd go with Elie Wiesel's Night,
sure.
His sort of memoir chronicle of his experience in the internment camps during the Holocaust, and you could even go with that full trilogy that he does of Night, Dawn, and Day as well, and thinking and ruminating on those ideas of, you know, how to cope with a God who is appearing to be silent through the hardest thing imaginable, the most evil thing imaginable. And so I think that's where I would go. I don't know that I have a full syllabus, but I think that dialogue between those works is interesting, if nothing else.
Yeah. The life and death of Ivan Desenovich is another sort of the prison camp story. Oh, yeah. Gotcha. In the Soviet era. Yeah.
I almost thought about just the idea of noise and silence. I'm also wanting to put Zone of Interest in there, I think, as well.
Yeah.
But anyway, I think I'm getting a lot of Holocaust stuff put in here, and I think that's, you know, a big thematically, you know, part of that experience.
Sure. I'm just thinking about like a class that really examines noise and silence and sound design. And
that'd be cool.
This film and Zone of Interest, I think, yeah, that's an interesting.
But yeah, because I mean, you know, you think about like the Stargate sequence in 2001 A Space Odyssey, which is almost like a sonic bombardment, right?
Sure.
You know, for that divine encounter as opposed to the other. So I think there is some range there that would be interesting. Yeah, that's a good idea. So for my syllabus, I think what I would do is probably, I'm thinking about an adaptation course, just the theories of adaptation and approaches to adaptation.
Gee, that might come up next week.
And, one of the people I've thought about is, you know, the way in which Alfred Hitchcock approaches adaptation, which is sort of read the book once and never pay attention to it again. So look at something like Rebecca, look at Psycho, look at Vertigo, all of which are based on.
You're off to a strong start.
Yeah. And so, I mean, yeah,
Just stay there.
It's just great stuff. And those approaches.
I think Garland's got a similar ethos when he does Annihilation too, remembering the book as a fever dream and wanting to capture that feeling.
Yeah. And then more like, again, sort of a more faithful but still with an auteuristic kind of stamp is Martin Scorsese. And so looking at his adaptations of Last Temptation of Christ, which is the better of these two Catholic films of his, I think, but we'll talk more about that when we get to that later. And then his approach to
Hugo?
Killers of the Flower Moon.
Killers of the Flower Moon. Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Killers of the Flower Moon is what
Good
I wanted.
Fellas.
Yeah.
Casino?
Casino. Not all of them are adaptations.
Cape Fear?
Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore?
Shutter Island?
The answer is Killers of the Flower Moon and then Silence.
The Departed.
Which...
Also an adaptation.
An adaptation of a film, but not a... Well, there's not a literary work upon which...
Infernal Affairs is just a film.
Infernal Affairs, yeah.
This is the third adaptation of Silence.
Yeah.
I knew there were multiple adaptations of that, yeah. And then auteurs, or not auteurs, but then adaptations that are less auteuristic. And I wanted to look at Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings trilogy in the class, which is pretty slavishly sort of just obedient to the text. I mean, Tom Bombadil's aside, it's pretty much the same thing. Which,
I think you get a really interesting conversation going if you bring in his King Kong, too.
Yeah, I think, which is an adaptation of film there in that case. But I'm really specifically thinking about literary adaptation.
Okay, sure. You want to stay on literature. Like
the page pro shows that sense, those feelings, as opposed to what we end up having realized in the visual audio experience of cinema itself. And so I think putting Hitchcock next to Scorsese, next to Jackson, as different ways to approach thinking about auteurism as that relates to that particular kind of adaptation. And then, you know, even looking at someone who does something that's really kind of strangely faithful, yet very, very different, the Rum Punch adaptation that Quentin Tarantino does for Jackie Brown would also be kind of an interesting way to think about that as well. And so that's kind of the milieu in which my mind is going right now.
Yeah, it's a fun class because not only do you get to, you can view these sort of different approaches to adaptation, but it's also you really get to throw a wrench into that idea of authorship.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's fun.
Because, how does an auteur get an auteur stamp on a movie like Vertigo if it's based on an existing property? Or how does Scorsese get a Scorsese stamp for something, like Last Temptation, Silence, which, again, I want to pair those two because, again, the religious material of them.
Yeah.
Kundun, I don't think, is based on an existing Buddhist text, but I don't know that for a fact off the top of my head. And I haven't seen Kundun in forever. It's been a long time.
I definitely saw it cited alongside this film and Last Temptation is sort of his most overtly, religious or faith-driven films.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think using Killers of the Flower Moon because of its sort of existence as a nonfiction text as an interesting sort of different kind of springing point might also inspire a different set of conversations as well in a classroom. And that's what a classroom's all about.
And I think especially interesting if you talk about the role of the church in Japan and the role of the church in North America and sort of Marty unpacking all of that.
Right.
Right. There's something very interesting going on.
Which brings up a very interesting question, but I believe it's now time to get down to business. It's business. It's business time. I don't know what you're trying to say. You're trying to say it's time for business. It's business time. Ooh, it's business. So, interesting fun fact.
Sure.
Two Catholic movies made by Martin Scorsese, we'll say. Mm-hmm. I mean, although ostensibly The Departed is in some senses a very much a Catholic movie as well.
I mean, a lot of his movies are Catholic movies. Yeah.
But, I mean, as sort of like overtly dealing with kind of Catholicism, those two films are Last Temptation of Christ and the movie Silence. Interestingly, Last Temptation of Christ was banned.
Sure.
And openly boycotted, which is a movie that simply depicts the humanity of Christ and him resisting temptation.
Well, look, Jesus can't be horny.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the problem, right?
Yeah.
Is that he's tempted, and again, in both the original novel and in the film, he resists said temptations and, goes to the cross and does the thing. It's a very, very sort of minimalized what's the word I'm looking for? Summarization of that film. But yeah, generally he still basically does everything that's, sort of lines up with the doctrine. And then we have a movie like Silence, which takes pretty great liberties with the historical events and then sort of becomes this meditation on this one man's journey of, faith and doubt and despair and apostasy and perhaps recovery of all of that. And that movie was, welcomed, screened at the Vatican.
Sure.
Interestingly enough, sure. The Roman Catholic Church has a lot of good to say about this movie, which I, for one, thinks is perhaps a reason to find one film suspect and another one laudable.
I think it. Yeah. Yeah. Is the short answer. It is interesting because Pope Francis has specifically spoken out about the role of the Catholic Church in the colonization of the global South and the quote New World, etc. Right. Like he's actually spoken out about these things and like that's bad. The church took part in genocide and that was a mistake. That's blasphemy. Straight up has called it blasphemy.
Sure. Which,
that's okay.
Which is correct.
These are steps towards, truth and reconciliation. However, I don't think you can understate the role of the Catholic Church in helping Spain and Portugal divvy up the entire fucking planet in the 15 and 1600s.
Sure.
You really can't understate what a... I'm going to choose my words so carefully. Often diabolical institution they were.
Yes.
And that's true of all institutions.
Absolutely.
Period.
I would, yes. Accepted.
Because that's what happens when people get that kind of power to play with.
And that's the thing I think that Garfield's Father Rodriguez character is unable to see, is that what all Inoue sees, and again, I think there is a sort of dual blindness. You know, this movie is all about the sort of absence of the sense of hearing here, but I think it's also a issue of an inability to see. That there is a blindness that Inoue has to the nuances of a doctrine and a belief that can, again, sort of flourish in a different kind of soil, which would take on different kind of character. And, you know, we'll talk more about that later.
Yeah, this question of sort of local, there's different words in it in different disciplines, but let's call it localizing religion.
Or contextualizing,
it's the word you usually hear for it. Yeah. What's the other one? I forget. I'll see if I can look it up.
Okay. But then there is this sort of ways in which the religion itself serves as an agency of, I'll use a biblical term here, empire. That religion serves in that sense. And so, yes, indeed, you know, we're adopting this faith, which is based out of a church which has its headquarters in Rome, Italy. But it, since it's coming from the Portuguese, it is furthering Portuguese interests, or Spain, Spanish interests, or England, English interests, or Holland, Dutch interests. And so that's the thing that Rodriguez can't see. Rodriguez cannot see the way in which that is serving as, you know, a sort of a handmaiden to empire. And what Inoue cannot see is this empire sort of approach to it, that there might be a separation between religious identity and empirical identity. Because, of course, the Japanese also have empirical sort of mindset concerning themselves and their own culture.
Sure.
And so, I mean, that's sort of one of those fundamental splits. And what we're kind of talking about here is separation of church and state.
Yeah,
which is a relatively novel idea in the course of human history.
Yeah,
but you know, is embedded in. I would say it's embedded in Buddhism, and it's embedded in Christianity, and it's embedded even to an extent in Islam. I mean, you know, the reading of Islam as the necessary creating of a caliphate is not, you know, part and parcel of the text. There are other ways to read that, and has been read in other ways historically and in contemporary sort of Muslim readings as well. And so the first sort of major layer that we're sort of wrestling with here is that idea of state churches.
Sure.
And the ways in which churches, when they are welded to the state, they form handmaidens to the state rather than sort of independent agencies of their own. Mm-hmm. Right? Does that make sense?
Totally.
And so, I mean, that I think that is the sort of missionary kind of rub there. I mean, you think about, and this is Protestants and Catholics, missionary schools in North America, in which Native Americans, in order to become Christians, they also have to give up their native languages, cut their hair, wear American dress, drive Studebaker cars, and drink Scotch whiskey, according to the movie Smoke Signals, which, you know, is a way to sort of inebriate and pacify a population, which is obviously also blasphemous.
Yes,
yeah.
Or of course glazing over, like the kidnapping.
The kidnapping and, right. And the smallpox blankets and the murdering and, you know, the burning and all that
stuff. How the kids get to the school in the first place.
Yes, yeah.
But obviously bad.
Yes.
And good to, and again, to cite it as blasphemous, I think is essential, right? To put the role of church, or let's, to look at the times throughout human history where religion, whichever one you want to talk about, has been used as a spear for hegemony. That is like inherently blasphemous to any idea of the divine that you want to conjure, in my mind, right? It is like an act that in and of itself, like, assumes superiority, which is the last thing you should do in a, you know, spiritual context. Pretty bad stuff.
It really is.
And it's interesting that, like, Inoue is such an interesting character. Just the ways in which he's like, and especially when we finally get to meet Ferreira as sort of somebody who's become friends with Inoue after, you know, apostatizing. And I forget what his Japanese name is, but what Ferreira, the Liam Neeson character, has to say to Rodriguez, the Garfield character, about basically just like, how can your faith be so small that this is such a hang up for you, basically? And how can your ego be so great that you are trying to force the situation to your martyrdom? Like, this isn't about you. Mm-hmm. People are suffering because of you.
Right.
And in God's silence, all we are left with is each other. And all that you can do in this situation is step on a picture to keep people from dying. And that's a pretty small act to do in right. the grand scheme of things. Step on me, my child.
Yes.
In some ways.
And I guess here is the... Okay. Right. And this is the interesting sort of specificity of this story. And I'm gonna draw a correlation here.
Okay.
And I'm gonna see if it fits. So in this very, very specific kind of act, set of behaviors, it is the morally just thing to do is to put one's foot on an image, right? Mm-hmm. In order to save other human lives. Mm-hmm. In order to again sort of die the death yourself in sort of a spiritual sense,
sure.
You know, in order that others might live and continue on, and you know that seems to be a good, you know, although you know in a spiritual sort of mindset, the life lived on earth is not the only life, and this, so there's other sort of ramifications sure. that are sort of important there. But I think fundamentally, I think that's the situation here. I want to talk about Christian pacifism, which is a different subject, mm-hmm. right? But I want to draw a corollary here. So Jesus has this teaching that we should turn the other cheek, that the default position of Christian believer would be to not use violence, to always bless and not curse, to generally approach life from looking for different solutions mm-hmm. for problems than those of physical violence. Does that make sense so far? Now, are there exceptions? And the answer is probably, right? This is sort of the thing that I've always heard. If I see my neighbor dragging their partner across the front lawn by their hair and I call 911, I probably don't wait for the police to get there, mm-hmm. right? He's going to catch hands in a situation like that. But there's a weird way in which... there is this sort of weird emphasis on this extreme sort of exceptional kind of mode, mm-hmm. you know, in which the general principle of turn the other cheek is set aside. And then we standardize the exception because we spend all of our time talking about this kind of exception. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And so one of the great problems in North American church is that every time I've ever heard much teaching on the Sermon on the Mount in this particular place, there's pretty much the entire budget of preaching time is sort of spent on the exceptions to make sure everybody knows sometimes it's okay to throw hands because we want to make sure you feel good about being able to still throw hands instead of a message that would emphasize the default of the believer is peacefulness. Mm-hmm. Right. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. I weirdly think that the messaging, I'm going on a long tear here.
No, you're cooking, bud.
I weirdly think that sometimes the misread of this message is, so what we need to do is make sure that faith is internal and it's just for me and mine and my own spirituality and that I don't want to rock any boats and I don't want to cause any injury or, you know, this kind of thing, you know, and which is all I think good and something I subscribe to, but that, that it's not that big a deal to be distinctive in one's understanding of the world and the universe and to present one's distinctions and understandings out for others to also hear.
That's valuable.
But this movie...
That's a different thing than proselytizing, though, right?
Well, I think here's a question I want to have.
I think proselytizing as the evangelical church has got it to be.
Yes.
I guess what I think what Dustin's talking about is maybe a kind
sharing
of
one's faith.
Yes. Proselytizing is a gentler word and a gentler act.
Yes.
And one that is a less.
I think very much the disciples were called to go into their neighbors and build relationships and have conversations and have discussions and to love them and help them.
And give an answer for the type of hope that they have. Right.
Yeah.
So I think one of the sort of wrong-headed ways in which I've seen this movie sort of approached is a different kind of hegemony.
Mm.
So we've seen Christian hegemony at work doing a terrible thing. Mm-hmm. And again, this is a story of an individual person in a very, very, very specific kind of situation where he says, I need to say no to my distinctives because it injures other people.
Yeah.
And I think there are circumstances in which that might be the case.
Yeah.
Right. But generally speaking, I think a person can be distinct, have distinct understandings, and try to be persuasive about their understandings in other contexts, right? And this movie then creates a different kind of hegemony in which, no, what we need to do is never, ever talk about our distinctives. Mm-hmm. That the general conversation is always going to remain, I'm going to use the word secular, but in secular, I also sort of mean non-denominational. Mm-hmm. By non-denominational, I mean also interreligious, that there's a way in which I seek to never, ever... be a flavor in the soup.
You know,
hear what I'm saying here?
Yeah, and maybe it's because, I don't really talk about this on the show very often. And maybe it's because the older I get, the more I find myself identifying with the label of Christian anarchist because I think the state and spirituality are so fundamentally meant to not coexist.
Yes.
And so I think it is, I feel as I get older and more comfortable with my identity, it's important for myself to be in Christian spaces with leftist politics and leftist spaces with Christian ethics. Mm-hmm. I think those are valuable. I think that's a valuable distinction.
Right.
Now let's get the fuck out of here because I'm tooting my own horn more than I'm comfortable with. But I guess to see, I see your point, and I think you make a good point, and I would agree with it for the most part.
Yeah, and so I think, but this is, again, we're talking about sort of like backward reactions to this movie. One backward reaction being like, don't ever proselytize, mm-hmm. right? Or one backward reaction being that missions is entirely a failed project, you know, which at times it has, but also hospitals.
Sure.
I mean, I know who invented those things, and it's a good thing that those things
Catholic
took place.
Priests invented liberation theology.
Yeah, yeah.
Enculturation was the word I was looking for earlier, by the way, as sort of a similar synonym for inculturation. That's what I said. Yeah, a synonym for contextual theology.
And there's something, again, I think this movie is beautiful because it's sort of like talking about the way in which any religious system is itself a dead thing if all that it is a strict code.
Yes.
You never put your foot on the thing, so therefore, you know, and then you keep the strict code and then everything is just hunky and also dory, as opposed to a divine-led ethic
mm-hmm.
where you are spiritually in tune with the circumstances and situations which you're placed in. You're also in tune with the tradition of which you are a part. And then you react to that situation in the appropriate, most loving kind of way. And again, both Buddhism, Islam, and Christianity would teach all of these things, right? We're not staking flags right now regarding that kind of thing. Rather than saying, a rule, don't apostatize, is probably a pretty good rule for pretty much all of the sort of belief systems, mm-hmm. I would tend to think, you know, is like, you know, stay the course is sort of a fundamental teaching of Marxism
it's interesting
existentialism.
It's so interesting how they bring Rodriguez. They're trying to give him a path towards being a clergy member as it is understood within Japanese culture.
Right.
And again, it's like part of this is like cultural contexts being so dissimilar from one another. And, you know, we're at a time in human history where the world is much, much more divided up.
Mm-hmm. And the great story of the missionary project has been a failure to contextualize, mm-hmm. you know, and I think that's sort of worth pointing out here.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. That's a great place for us to pivot to something else. Cause I was just kind of getting at like this larger, again, it's another bad reading here is sort of the Ferrer reading, right? And to have Ferrer instead of Inoue say it kind of colors this, the very Western perspective this film has of like, this is swampy land in which the seeds of Christian faith cannot grow. And that's sort of a weird, narrow view of another culture to have.
It's oddly paternalizing, isn't it?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
It is sort of that kind of Western thing of like, yes, we understand these noble people better than they understand themselves or whatever mm-hmm. the case may be in whatever context we're, you know, it happened a bunch over the course of about 400 years. So there's too many examples to pull one really.
But I would say one of the most beautiful things, well, I mean, just think about Buddhism. Let's just think about Buddhism in general, that there's a difference between
Chinese... Because I know more
about
that than Shintoism, so that's maybe we should steer clear of that.
You know, there's
a
difference between like sort of Mahayana, sort of, you know, the version of it that we have in China, you know, mm-hmm. sort of out of Shaolin, mm-hmm. you know, and its relationship to martial arts, as opposed to what's called Pure Land Buddhism. That's sort of the flavor that it takes in Japanese mm-hmm. Sort of understandings. And there are some significant distinctions between them, but they are still fundamentally Buddhist. What sort of the problem of Catholicism that sort of is being named here is that there are different cultural flavors that it might take on. And yes, there are, we'll say, Christian heresies that probably would need to be. If you want to call yourselves Christians, you probably need to not recognize Jesus as the ball of burning gases, you know, around which the earth spins. You know, that would probably be a sort of proper correction, I would think, but also that after that correction would make, it would still take on some genuinely Japanese sort of contexts and flavors. The real reason for the Protestant Reformation has much more to do with cultural differences between Northern Europe and Southern Europe than it has to do with actual proper theology. Mm. I mean, there have been a number of sort of ecumenical sort of meet and greets between doctrines of justification between Lutherans and sort of Italian Catholics, and they find themselves to be kind of a hair's breadth one from another, you know, which is a famous comment that Wesley made about the difference between his particular brand of Protestantism and the difference between that and Calvinism is a hair's breadth of difference there. But there are distinctions, and those distinctions are important, and that conversation matters, and yada, yada, yada. But, you know, allowing the flavor of a culture that is going to express itself in slightly different kind of ways.
And I mean, that's why Mexican Catholicism is like this whole very specific thing and has, you know, this kind of mixture of, like, you know, folk religion and you know, I don't know enough about it to speak. I'm trying to think of the name of that, the sort of saint of death. I can't think of her.
Oh, I know who you're talking about. Yeah.
Sort of that sort of fixture.
Well, I mean, I just think about, you know, I mean, I hang out with a lot of Pentecostals where I teach, and I'll tell you what, American Pentecostalism looks very, very different from African Pentecostalism.
I'm sure.
Which looks very, very different from South American Pentecostalism. And I would dare say Asian Pentecostalism probably bears in some ways a lot more resemblances, in, especially in Korea, to American Pentecostalism. But there are still some real distinctives there that, again, are mostly flavor than they are base or content, but still there are significant differences. And it seems that that's one of the things that it seems that the Portuguese missionaries are not really looking to plant seed in land. That's what I kept thinking. It's they wanted to move a potted plant and just let it set in the sun there.
Yeah.
That seems to be the issue. Well, and that there's a different metaphor, but every time they start talking about this land being a swamp, it's like, it feels like you're just moving a plant to a different room and the room's too cold. And you're not putting it in the dirt and let it take on those different kind of, like, a hydrangea characteristics when it expresses its fruit in a different kind of way.
Conversation of metaphors that Inoue and Rodriguez have about concubines and trees.
Oh,
and
yeah.
This is related to this, right? Like, this is the very conversation they have.
Right.
It's very interesting. It is sort of a problem they seem to have. Is that there is a need for them, right? And this is, again, sort of a question of, like, what is the role of clergy? And that's kind of a question the movie asks, you know, what is the role of clergy here versus here in Japan versus where these guys come from? And it's interesting just because of the nature of, like, Catholicism at that time, let's say. The role of the priest is so essential. They are the conduit to the divine.
Well, the daimyo. I mean, that's that seems to be the different take the Japanese are taking there is that it's much more like a daimyo kind of situation than it is like a religious officer in some senses.
Yeah, they kind of talk about him also having, like, soft hands, basically, and how, like, Catholic priests or these Jesuits aren't working the way, like, Buddhist monks are working.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's sort of, they don't really get into that a lot, but it's sort of an interesting, like, just cultural difference that
gets touched
on.
I've met some Carmelite monks, though. I'll tell you what, those cats have calluses on their hands.
I'm sure that this is, you know, specific to this film's take on Rodriguez.
Though generally saying Jesuits have softer hands of the orders, that's probably fair.
They're more academic.
I'm a little shade at the Jesuits.
More academic. Okay. That's fair.
But I like Jesuits fine.
I'm also interested in, again, the sort of the inherent politics of telling impoverished and oppressed people that paradise will come for them tomorrow when heaven can be a place on earth. Just sort of interesting politicking going on. Just sort of the inherent politics of religion in some ways.
Yeah.
Right. And the way in which it can be very easily used to get people to offload their best interests onto the promise of a better day, whether it's in the context of American slavery or the context of colonization. Like, it's been that idea has been used for ill.
Yeah, there's a seductive politics there. And I think Karl Marx sort of diagnoses this. And it's weird because, you know, oftentimes this quote from Marx that, you know, religion is the opiate of the masses is sort of his most sort of anti-religious line. And the rest of the text, which I've read, suggests that it's a medicine in the midst of suffering. It's letting them know that the suffering will eventually end is the idea there for that. And so it's not quite as sort of incisive rebuke that some of your more of your Hitchens type Marxists might take a line like that. But I do think that the politics of this, you know, Christianity at its best, and I would say Buddhism at its best, and Islam. And again, I think there are real distinctions, and I'm going to advocate a kind of pluralism here in a minute, but it's not the sort of wishy-washy, oosey-gooshy, you know, it's all the same. I don't actually think that. I think something different, but distinct. Okay. I see you grinning there.
I'm grinning because I like it when you say these things. Because we're not like totally in agreement, but we're not that far apart on this sort of line of thinking.
But the proper politics is that there are real world problems that religion can address, that it can organize human beings to care for the widows and orphans and poor among them, that it can do some things where it changes the state of affairs, where there are less widows and orphans and poor, you know, I mean, not less widows, because I
guess, what you're saying,
you know what I mean? The situation is not cat food eating any longer, that the situation itself is educationally, medically, financially better, that this side of eternity world can be improved, and that's what Buddhism at its best, Islam at its best, and Christianity at its best works towards, is to end that kind of suffering. And when it does that, yes, and then it also suffers alongside those who are suffering. Again, that is a very, very good thing, you know. But it can also be simply like, hey, by the way, just, you know, send your check here. You know, the charlatan is some kind of version of it where it's, and by the way, your treasures are in heaven. Don't worry about this now.
Ooh, I'm sorry about the hurricane you're experiencing, but my doors are locked.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. That's bad religion.
Yeah.
You know,
well, and you know, that's, you kind of talked about just now, it's at its most innocuously bad. Right. It's just sending a check. At its worst, it's causing the very problems.
Yes.
It's saying it is there to solve,
which
is, again, like in this specific film, in the specific story, that is sort of why, in a way, it's been put in this position, is because there were, throughout, you know, the history of Christianity in Japan, there were, you know, I don't know the exact daimyos, maybe is the title that I should use, but, you know, large, like powerful samurai families who would convert to Christianity in the hope of consolidating power and getting outside assistance from these foreign powers.
Well, this is like Constantine and the Edict of Milan.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and this is again getting into the separation of church and state stuff that we've already sort of dipped our toes into, as far as it becomes a weapon when the state wields it.
Yeah.
Because if your only tool is a hammer, everything is a nail. Right.
Yeah.
That's sort of the problem. Do we want to talk about the silence of God? We haven't really got into that yet.
Yeah, we really should. Yeah, but yeah, before we do pluralism or whatever. Yeah.
And that might be a good segue to that.
Yeah, yeah. And
because that's one thing I think we can all agree on, regardless of what denomination or
how
faith.
The best religious movies are, generally, the most sort of the ones that make the big list and the ones that we talk about a lot are all those that sort of engage with that particular aspect of, you know, sort of spirituality, is that idea of silence, that we see something like First Reformed, and it's a movie we all love a lot, Hozar Balthazar, which we talked about from Bresson, and Bresson's Diary of a Country Priest, which is very similar to that, or a movie like Stalker, which we've all really kind of loved, that they all kind of address this sort of God in silence. Why is it that those are the movies that we tend to resonate? Is, I guess, like a first softball I want to throw into this.
Feels like they're actually tackling something of meat and worth. I can't think of many other religious movies that aren't sort of are on that. Like the other ones that are, that are, you know, I mean, outside of maybe the Ten Commandments, which is a big, you know, studio pick, or Ben-Hur. But I think even in getting into Ben-Hur, Spartacus, you're going to deal with some of these themes as well. It's been a long time since I've seen Ben-Hur. I haven't seen Spartacus, but I know, you know, some about them. But it's really two sides of a coin, right? I mean, when you have the auteurs making these sorts of films and they're adapting these sorts of works, these are the kind of questions that spiritualists reckon with and wrestle with and try to deal with, because it, you know, I just started reading The Problem of Pain with C.S. Lewis, and this is kind of the great problem of pain, right? Is the silence of God when bad things are happening, or we're struggling, or we're going through strife, or, evil is occurring, and you know, how do we reconcile that? Right, that's the kind of great existential, I think, spiritual question, Christian question, religious question, and I think it's the one that all these movies sort of engage with in really interesting and compelling ways, with interesting and compelling characters who at times feel real or at times feel like we can identify with. And the other side of the coin are the movies that are just kind of preaching to the choir.
Yeah.
And there's no real depth to their theology. There's no real depth to the questions they're asking. It's the same kind of stuff that you can get within a church, within a Sunday school, that maybe valid, viable questions that aren't really being wrestled with in any sort of complex way.
Yeah, I think a real depth of faith requires that sort of questioning and requires that sort of uncertainty, right? How can you have faith in something if you are certain of it? It's sort of, you know, the ideas do not go together well, right? I don't know. And maybe it's because I'm less interested in sort of, let's say, the divinity of Yeshua of Nazareth as much as I am invested in sort of his political project of tearing down institutions that do not serve people and uplifting people who do serve each other. And, you know, again, this commitment to let's keep it off of like a guy whose historicity is debated and people love to yell at each other about it. Let's just talk about Tolstoy, right? Like a dude who grew up of money, saw suffering in his home country and took a vow of poverty basically to help better, you know, conditions in his country, and saw, you know, leftist thought in his country and said, this is good, but how does it serve these peasants whose basic, like, whose core experience of reality is so fundamentally like about their faith? Like, how do you bring this idea of like, especially a conception of leftist politics that doesn't make room for faith or the church? How do you like bring these people who are the proletariat you're supposed to care about? How do you bring them under the banner? Right. So I think Tolstoy is great for this kind of thing of thinking about, you know, if you read The Kingdom of God is Within You, like it's him exchanging letters with other theologians being like, oh, so you noticed that the state is wielding the church as a sword too, huh? I'm not the only one that noticed this. Cool. Good. We should do something about that.
Right.
So it is interesting that like you see these, the struggle of, I don't know what I want to say like authenticity, but like who is serving humanity, who is doing the work of the divine and who is manipulating things to their advantage.
Right. So you see the sort of engagement with this idea of God's silence is that the institution itself no longer speaks for God.
Yes.
Is the fundamental sort of thing that you
I think so.
That
yeah.
resonates think with you.
The silence of God
if
is
I
like
put those words in your mouth.
Yeah. No, I think if you can put words in my mouth. Yeah. That fits for me. And I think like the role of the silence is for us to live in and speak to fill the silence. Like our job is to take care of each other because of the silence. Like that is the proof that of the silence is for where God lives, right?
Yeah,
that's where the magic is living in the silence.
That's good. For me, I think there's two reasons why I think they resonate. One of them is that I think that silence, those times of the silence of God, those times of suffering are the times when we are more prone to start asking those questions, that when things are sort of hitting well in our lives and the stories about people whose lives are hitting well, that there's less of that sort of inquisitiveness about theological kind of questions in general. The other reason why I think that they really resonate is that these movies tend to be discussion starters rather than announcements, that the other kind of religious movies are sort of here, I'm announcing this information now and presenting it now, rather than these are the sets of questions that my faith sort of conjures within me. And that's I think that's part of why they resonate so well. And very good. Yeah, good. Well done, fellas.
You're just saying you're gonna have deeper conversations with A Hidden Life than you are Fireproof.
Yes, I think so.
Well, yeah, I think I could have a real conversation about the divine with Marty. I watch Kirk Cameron Saving Christmas and I'm like, somebody hold my beer and my jacket, please. I have to do some work on this man.
Yeah.
I just like, it's so interesting, like how these institutions like interact with human lives and how like one personality, one psychology, like internalizes and fulfills one mission and one another, right? It is just, this is sort of, to me, part of the silence, right? Is like how people are interpreting what we tell each other, the stories we tell each other to try and get through the silence, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. It's, I don't know, man, it's messy. It's not clean. So let's, maybe this is a good time to talk about pluralism, right? Because if we say like one version of Christianity, the prosperity gospel, let's say, right?
Sure.
That's sort of, if we, I want to pick something that we can all be on the side against, let's
sure.
say. Not that we need to drag Christianity today, but sometimes it needs to get dragged.
Sure.
So let's say, where does Martin Scorsese's sort of faith questioning, curious, lapsed Catholicism fit in with something like a Kirk Cameron or Joel Osteen prosperity gospel? And where does that fit in with, you know, there being other paths up the mountain, let's say?
Yeah. One of them's sincere.
Right. I mean, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. But how do you know someone's sincerity, right? How do you know if someone's a grifter or someone's, you know, an idiot, right? Like where is the grift? Where is the sincerely an asshole?
It seems to me that there's this sort of like within a given tradition that there is space to critique, criticize, and correct. Right. And so that
And then we're staying on that because that's what this movie is about.
Yeah. And so right. that the tradition should correct itself and that it's never so hyper individualistic or hyper contextualized that it's never part of a larger growing global kind of community. And so like this idea that Jesus is the S-U-N son that probably needs criticism within a Christian generally, but Catholic specifically
theology.
Kind of context there. And so the prosperity gospel should be confronted with, I don't know, the gospels would be a good place to start. that lovingly believers ought to confront, correct, and spur one another on to better and better kind of things there. There's another kind of pluralism that's sort of at work, though, in the movie that's like, Inouye is evil, but so is the project of the Portuguese. You know, I'm not going to say
two things can be true.
Yeah, two things can be true. The Portuguese missionary project itself is also an evil, using
the boss of the church 500 years later would call it a blasphemy.
Right.
Let's say.
But I would say that good guys would be people like Father Rodriguez and the Buddhist monk who does his funeral.
Yeah.
That those are amongst the various kinds of good guys. Mm-hmm. And that a real pluralism is not you don't talk about yours, I don't talk about mine, and we go about business without acknowledging the sort of existence of one another. But a real robust pluralism is that in the marketplace of living life and presenting ideas, that I have the way in which I can talk about my Bush Mills version of Christianity, and then someone else can talk about their Jameson version of Christianity, and someone else can talk about their Saki version of Buddhism, and I don't know, Japanese liquor at all. Or Chinese liquor.
I was going to say soju for Korea.
There's soju Buddhism.
And then we got to get the mineral water and the mocktails in here too,
but,
right?
But, I mean, you know,
and the mead and the Vikings.
Yeah, sure.
But there is this sort of buffet of options of understanding, connection to the spirit. This is why the alcohol thing is an important sort of joke here. That there are these sort of different ways in which, you know, spirit, and that we present them as ideas together, and that they are real options for everybody to take, that there really is a genuine marketplace in which this idea can be presented and then to be demonstrated to be a better way to live life, or, you know, a deficient way to live life, and that people get to make their own minds up about that's what real pluralism looks like, where it you can be as your particular denominational flavor of Christianity in its distinctions and all of its distinctiveness, and that someone can also be as their particular flavor of Buddhism, their Chan Buddhism, you know, from Chinese, or their Pure Land version of Buddhism from Japan, that they can do those things together, and that persons on the outside can both say, I can choose this or that or neither, and that all of those are real options and no one is being silenced.
I mean, that's truly what we should hope for, right?
Yeah.
I had a note about Grace for the Betrayer, but I don't really think we have time to get into it.
Yeah, of all the characters I identify in that movie, it's Kikichiro that I identify with the most.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah, I see myself in that guy. Yeah. I also see myself in Liam Neeson, right?
Mm.
You know? Mm-hmm. Just like, yeah, I'll help you find the contraband, and I'll tell you how this is all actually, you know, up its own ass and backwards. And
yeah.
I'll do the thing. because I'm tired of watching people get killed.
Right.
I'm tired of it. I'm tired of watching people get killed for no good reason.
Yeah.
But yeah, Kikichiro is like a really interesting character. Mm-hmm. And again, like obviously the 300 pieces of silver is such a like obvious nod to the stuff, the croak. Isn't there a rooster crows in the book when he apostatizes?
When he apostatizes, there's a rooster crow. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know that even in the film, there's some allusions to sort of Paul and denying Christ. And,
Peter.
I said Paul. And as soon as I said, I was like, wait, that's not right.
Yeah. Peter's denials.
Yeah. Heavy movie.
Yeah, for sure.
Heavy movie. What do we think about his final display of faith? Maybe we can go out on that.
Yeah, I don't know, because there's part of me that says, okay, he held his sort of internal... I think that the movie's universe has for us this idea that he held on to his internal faith and that he did this external action in a sort of this loving act of self-sacrifice for others, mm-hmm. yet maintain an internal relationship with Jesus somehow throughout, you know, that seems to be what the movie wants us to think with that. And I think that's the internal logic of the movie. And I think that's very, very lovely there. But I also wonder sometimes about this idea about being more interested in the emblems than the actual substance, which is a criticism he makes of the Japanese himself. And so he's just got a little emblem with him and no substance is another way to read it.
Yeah.
And I don't know which of the options is better.
I think they're both valid is kind of the thing, right? That's the ambiguity in some ways. Hmm. I don't know. I mean, that's, we don't get to know what Rodriguez was like after he, you know, takes a Japanese name and, you know, lives as a dead samurai.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. And then we don't really get to know like what his role as clergy, what, Freire's, role as clergy is, other than sort of, they write about astronomy and look for Christian artifacts being brought in by the Dutch.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely interesting. I don't know. I guess don't persecute people for their beliefs and don't force your beliefs on other people and, you know, minimize suffering where you can.
Right.
These are the lessons of the day.
I think those are probably all good lessons. I think so. Yeah. Speak your mind, but you know, don't expect anything.
Yeah.
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 And it's okay for people to disagree.
Yeah.
Also good. So Arthur's out. Well, what do you say about Silas? Do you like it, shelf or trash? What do you say, Arthur?
No. I would put it on a shelf for a number of reasons. So I think it would go on a shelf.
Now, what do you say, Dalton? Shelf or trash?
I think it is not a movie for everybody, but that's kind of what makes it a movie for everyone. I think this is a challenging film and it's got its reason. I think lots of different people of lots of different backgrounds and relationships to faith will, I'm very interested in a Japanese perspective on this film, a Buddhist perspective on this film. But as far as like my contexts go, I think most of the people I know, you know, will have some context that will make this film personally resonant.
Yeah.
For them. So I think it's very, a very valuable film. And it's a shame that it's one of Marty's more underseen films.
Yeah. I'm also going to say shelf because I do think it does have a resonance for like a number of different kinds of audiences.
Mm-hmm.
And it hits a bunch of demographics and sort of in the spiritual spectrum of understanding the world. And so, yeah, I think it's a really, really great film. And I do think it is criminally underseen. It's a very, very good movie. So we're probably wrong about everything we've said, and we probably need to get some feedback. And Dalton's going to tell you how to get it to us.
Oh, God, yeah. Not looking back forward to feedback on this one. Actually, I am. If ever you are going to write feedback, this is the one you should do it for. I'm interested. I legitimately want to know what you think. I had a great time watching this movie with my friend Taylor, who is, let's just say, not positive on the church overall, and positive on really religion at all. And it was a very, very fun who's also watching Shogun. So he's a really fun person to watch this movie with. I am very much interested on different perspectives on this movie. So if you've got thoughts, please send those thoughts to goodtrashgenrecast@gmail.com. Once again, that is goodtrashgenrecast@gmail.com. If you have thoughts on Silence or any other films we've covered or any films you'd like to see us cover. Speaking of films you'd like to see us cover, you can go to patreon.com/GTM, as already mentioned. Thank you once again to Keith and Smith. We love you, buddy. Thank you for helping us keep the lights on, and I hope our discussion of Silence was to your liking. Can't wait to see what you pick for us next year. And again, if you want to be like Keith and pick a movie for us to talk about on the show, you can go to patreon.com/GTM. Find out more information there. What else? Arthur started posting on the old Insta. Started posting episode links and reminders that the new stuff's out. So you can follow us over on Insta at Good Trash Media. And then our personal handles are there on the landing page.
They're usually attached to our names in some way.
Yeah, yeah. You can find us. We're all on Letterboxd. I think we're pretty easy to find on there. You know our names. You can find us. What else? Check out the Praise Down with Heath and Alex. I was talking to Heath the other day, and he's kind of like thinking about wanting to gear back up and might start making some more episodes. But there's like 130 plus episodes in that feed for you to check out. Several years of podcasting to enjoy, and an excellent pairing to this episode of Silence. I mean, I know Dustin and I were both guests on the Praise Down talking about our journeys and our walks at various points. Lots of good people of different backgrounds talking about their faith backgrounds. Some really great interviews featured on the Praise Down, and also some good silliness too. You can also check out The Wheel of Randy with Dan Wade, which is a show where Dan discusses the music of legendary American songster Randy Newman. They cover an original and a cover each episode, and kind of break down the Tao of Randy, as it were. All that and more from the Good Trash Media Network. I've already plugged the Patreon. I usually do that last, so now I'll say, Arthur, is it my turn? No, it's not my turn yet. It's your turn. It's a regular programming week.
Yeah, it's just a regular week.
And I know what we're going to watch, but I'm going to keep up the kayfabe and pretend I have no idea. What are we watching?
I'm an ex-shock.
Are we watching The Hunted with Benicio del Toro Lee Jones? Oh my goodness!
There was an audible. Yes. An audible in the middle of the week.
Why would you have done that?
Well, you know, once in a while things come out in new release that we get a chance to watch, and they're somewhat near and dear to our hearts in some form or fashion. And so a movie dropped about, I guess now a month ago, I think.
As you're hearing this.
Time is all sorts of cattywampus in this show.
It's yesterday in our world, yes. But not so much in yours.
Yeah, I don't know when anything's happening anymore. But next week, we're going to lighten the mood once again. And we're taking a little trip to the Florida Keys to watch a film. And I was thinking this was like the first instance of us doing a remake of a movie we'd already covered. But we've done that a few times now. We've done so many episodes, so it's hard to keep track sometimes of what is done for the first time. But we're going to check in on Dalton's namesake when we take a look at the brand new 2024 take on Roadhouse.
Conor McGregor ass shots. Can't wait.
There's going to be a lot of that. But you keep watching and we'll keep talking. And we'll see you all next time.